So this morning they reiterate the attitude of relaxed attention, welcoming receptivity . Let these words kind of just not be imperatives or, trying to do anything, just as kind of helpful guidelines or comforting words, a sense of receptivity and openness rather than you've got to put forth the effort and try to get something. Or you've got to spend this hour, trying to control your mind or get rid of negative thoughts. So the way that we can oftentimes regard meditation as controlling, methods to control and get rid of things we don't like, trying to attain states that we would like. So it's like not having to do anything, get anything, go anywhere, be anybody. Now this way of reflecting affects me quite nicely. It's because of the tendency to the habit tendency, the conditioning that was very strong of work hard, practice hard, control, get rid of, and try to attain the work ethic. The sense of relaxed attention, openness, trust was, even though I could understand the words, I didn't find this, but I found that this would create a lot of doubts because the conditioning of the mind was always around that hard work paid off and striving and trying and making yourself ascetic, more like an ascetic style. Seemed like you were really doing something, getting somewhere. Where this other not going anywhere, not doing anything, relaxed attention, sounded like something that I would mistrust. Like how could you ever get enlightened just by just sitting here and relaxing, opening? So that this is the observing the thinking process, the way one thinks. The personality then, Sakyaditti, is a creation of thought. You really, really explore this during this retreat. To become a personality, you have to create it. You have to think, I am this body, I am this monk, I am this nationality, me and mine. I'm like this, you're like that. Now that's thinking, isn't it? That takes language. We each have separate names, so we separate us. I'm Ajahn Sumedho, there's Ajahn Panyasaro, Ajahn Natthiko, Ajahn Tanya, they're separate from me. I'm Sumedho, and they have these other names. This is thought, isn't it? Notice that this creates separation, the illusion of separation, of difference. Monks, nuns. There's a male and female. These are words, concepts that emphasize a certain quality or a certain condition or difference. And whatever, if you emphasize masculinity, then you've got femininity along with it. You can't, masculinity doesn't mean anything on its own. So heaven and hell, you know, is eternal heaven, is the idea of, like last night, talking about an eternal state of happiness and security that we can conceive of just by thinking of a place that's always this beautiful, stable, refined, safe, happy, loving, warm, comfortable. There's nothing, no pests, no snakes, no worms, no mosquitoes. And so we can, you know, that's a, then because of that, that's a superlative, that's a thought, those are thoughts. Thought can become superlatives, take thinking to the best possible thing you can think of, but it also includes the worst. So hell is the absolute worst. That's worst. And heaven is best. Now, best and worst then are concepts, words, and they do affect us. Because the desire is wanting the best and not wanting the worst. So with this relaxed attention, it's not, you know, the because it's an immanent being. It's not a state that I can attain through a willful act. It's more like a surrendering, relaxing, trusting, resting in the moment, being here. As soon as I think, I've got to relax, I'm too tense, and I've got to relax, then the sense of myself, my separateness, and that I've got to, I shouldn't be the way I am, I shouldn't be tense. You can't really meditate properly if you're tense. I've got to learn how to relax. And then the whole stressful scenario takes us over. So you spend the hour here trying to relax, being frustrated because you're expecting something, you know, something good to happen through holding the ideas, having ideas and opinions about yourself or meditation or what I'm saying. So in this awareness, then, there's no self. Because now what I mean by that is, it's empty. I'm aware. There's awareness, but it's non. It's not. I'm not thinking. I'm trying to be aware. I've got to develop mindfulness, or I'm not creating anything or identity with it, or following any compulsive tendencies I might have in the present, and just observing, witnessing, receiving. Listening. (Clears throat) But there is alertness, there is attentiveness. But it isn't forced, it isn't, you know, concentrated on an object, trying to absorb into an object or, you know, doing anything like that. This is just bare attention, attentiveness, openness, receptivity. It's more like not knowing, the don't know mind. Just repeat that to yourself. Don't have to know anything. Don't know. The Korean Zen teacher uses that as a technique. Don't know mind. Don't know mind. But that's quite skillful, actually, because there is, you know, one of the kinds of Dunha is wanting to know, have answers, figure it all out. And that sense of not knowing can be something that we feel very uncomfortable with. Because it's good to know everything, isn't it? And be clever and figure everything out. But also observe this, like not knowing. It's just like saying, if you're trying to figure out what I'm saying, you don't have to figure it out. Just know that the way I'm talking, the tone of voice, or the suggestions I'm giving affect you like this. It's this way. Now this sound of silence then is what I is very prominent in when this state of letting, this natural state of letting go. This is how I experience it. But then if, you know, and some of you find this difficult because you're trying to find the sound of silence. You know, you get the idea of it, and you think that you've got to hear this, and so you're actually, you know, if you trust yourself just to observe the, you know, if you don't even know what I'm talking about, what is the sound of silence? Just trust yourself to observe, not knowing it. Don't make it into a problem, and don't look for it. Don't see any tendency that you have about thinking that you want to hear this sound of silence, or that, you know, I'm saying you should practice with this, or anything you might, you know, be picking up. Just be aware of it. It's like this. What is the experience now that is present? Not looking for something that you're not observing at this time, but imagining something you'd like to get. But it is empty, and it's not created, it's like this. No, it's noticing the way it is. This is like reflecting or investigating. This is when I'm with this sound of silence, resting in this state of not knowing, of just being, like this. So even the state of using words like state of being or resting, these aren't attainments or things to try to get. But if we use language, then use the language more or less for reflecting on the way it is. This sitting here, attentive, relaxed, receiving, is like this. You know, so it's like this is includes everything. It's not like this as something in particular. It's the way it is. Now then, this is what I call emptiness, sunyata. Now the word emptiness or sunyata is a Pali. I mean that word can become a kind of, you know, and we can think of it as maybe an attainment, or you know, we form an idea around emptiness. But I'm not trying to fit this experience into an idea of emptiness, but you know, trusting the wisdom of the present moment, this sense, this openness, receptivity. You know, it's empty. It's not. I'm not creating anything into it. I'm not doing anything with it. Just being it, being this emptiness itself. So it's not thinking or an analytical, or critical or judging. Then noticing non-self, anatta. If I start thinking, I'm sitting here listening to sound of silence, then I'm creating this concept of myself as me, somebody doing something now, practicing meditation. That takes thinking, doesn't it? That's the thing. I am sitting here practicing emptiness. That's not it. It's anatta, or trying to convince myself that, you know, that I don't have a self is still, you know, it's not it. Trying to believe in anatta or non-self, but this emptiness, this state of just being attentive in the present, resting open, the thinking process doesn't dominate anymore. So there's breathing and there's feeling and the things are functioning, but there's no sense of a self, because I'm not thinking about myself. I'm not creating myself. So then this is anatta. So then, non-attachment, desirelessness, viraga, this is viraga too. I'm not attaching to any desires. Desirelessness is like this. Just noticing the way it is. For a desire to arise, I've got to, you know, for to get lost in desire, you know, conditions arise into certain conditions that affect this being here, desire arises. But my relationship to desire now is one of knowing rather than of grasping. So desires can arise, but with this awareness, then one doesn't grasp the desires, the conditions and potential for desire is still present. But you know desire. You're not trying to, you know, trying to get rid of desires is vipavadana. It's called those catch-22 problems, isn't it? I've got a desire to get rid of all these desires. And where are you going to win on that level, you know? You just go around in circles because trying to get rid of desire is another kind of desire. So what is the way out of the desire realm? The only way you can get out of it is by observing it. Dhanha, gama dhanha, pava dhanha, vipava dhanha, or the desires that come through seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. So then if you start conceiving, I'm a person with a lot of desires, and then you're back into that realm again. Desire is, you know, then the word desire even sounds rather, you know, it's pejorative. It shouldn't have desires. A good bhikkhu is desireless. Look at me, you know, full of greed and... But this desire, you know, the second noble truth, the origin or causes of suffering. And this is to be, you know, the insight then is to really know. You know, don't be frightened of desire. Study it. You know, if desire arises, really take advantage and observe it. It's like this. Wanting to become, ambition, trying to attain is like this. Wanting to get the jhanas, wanting to become a sotapanna. Don't be afraid of these kind of desires, you know. Don't go around thinking, I shouldn't, you know, I don't want to be a sotapanna. And I don't want the jhanas. I just want to be like Ajahn Sumedho says, you know, just relaxed attention. Not going anywhere. That's what I want to... And that's a desire too, isn't it? What's the difference, you know, when you're trying to get the jhanas or trying to be, you know, what you think I want you to be. So this is where the you know... You could really look at desire and study it. Vipavadanha, this strong urge to resist and control, push away, avoid. So examining vipavadanha, you know, listen intentionally. I don't want this. I don't like this. I don't want this feeling. I don't want these desires and these bad thoughts, and I don't want anger and fear and jealousy and things. I don't want any of these. And so listening to, I don't want, I don't like, listening to this thing in me that wants to get rid of this, avoid, run away from. You know, so I even exaggerate it, you know, so that I can really know it. It's not just a kind of furtive acknowledgement of it and then run away again, but really an interest in this avoidance, controlling, fear-ridden tendency that makes me want to run away and get rid of or deny, resist things that are threatening or difficult. It's like this. The, you know, the more you investigate this desire, dunha, sensual desire, desire for becoming, the desire to attain, achieve. And these are quite noble desires too, some, you know. Desire to become a stream enterer is a good thing. It's a good desire. So it's not a matter of criticizing or judging, you know, it's good, bad, or right, wrong, wholesome and unwholesome desires. Get to know desire, you know, desire is desire. Dunha, ubadana, the clinging, the grasping of it. So in investigating that point of grasping, of dunha, ubadana, upadana is a grasping or clinging to desire. So clinging to vipavadanha is being taken over by it. You know, like it seems a good thing to get rid of anger. So suddenly something arises, something happens, and I feel this anger rising. And then the tendency resist trying to get suppress it, deny it. And it seems like a good thing, you know, that you shouldn't follow anger, speak in anger or act in anger. And maybe what happened is, you know, is I'm just being unreasonable. You know, some little thing, some little mistake somebody made, banging the door or can trigger off some kind of anger. But I can be reasonable. Well, it doesn't matter. It just, you know, don't be so. You're just an angry person. I mean, you get upset by little things, and you shouldn't. You know, you should be more patient. And so, you know, the inner critic is telling you shouldn't feel the way you're feeling, or you shouldn't let things upset you like they do. And that's good, you know, it's true, you know, you shouldn't be angry over somebody, you know, slamming the door or or, you know, like yesterday, this woman came in late offering the food, and she managed to touch everything on the counter. When you're trying to receive it, the idea is once you offer the food, you don't touch anything. And she's trying to help, you know, by making room for this, and then trying to. And I could feel this kind of sense of, you know, frustration. Don't touch the food. and she was making an offering, you know, which. These are the kind of things, don't be so silly, you know, or don't be so, you know, fussy about the rule, the idea of being grateful for the generous offering, and yet feeling this kind of aversion to, you know, the fact that she touched everything. We shouldn't feel like that. And I don't like feeling like that, personally. But in awareness, you know, that this is the conditions for that particular feeling are present. So it's not a matter of how I should or shouldn't feel, but just observing the way I am feeling, what arises. It's like this. Desire, upadana, dhanha, upadana, bhava, then I become bhava, exploring this paticca samuppada, dependent origination, bhava is becoming. And when I attach to desire, even the desire to get rid of desire, become a person again, somebody who doesn't want to have these petty feelings, who doesn't, you know, doesn't respect this petty mood that I'm experiencing right now. And that's, you know, that seems like a noble thing, to not, to really, you know, try to get rid of this kind of meanness of heart or pettiness that might arise, because I don't like it and don't want it. So it seems very right to suppress it or get rid of it. Or maybe it's opportunity, you know, how we look at it. To listen and not through the critical mind. This is not a critical function, but observe, it's like this. Not wanting it to be like this, it's like this. And so this gives then this questioning, inquiry, that which is aware of this feeling of being annoyed or upset by something is awareness isn't upset. And it's like noticing that the pure awareness doesn't get upset. It's aware of the feeling of upsetness. So you begin to differentiate, you know, the aramana, the object. The dhanha is an aramana, it's an arom, it's something that comes and goes. It's dependent on conditions. You know, so when the conditions for being upset, then this is an upset is the feeling, or anger, or greed, or lust, or envy, or fear. So the awareness then isn't frightened, isn't lustful, isn't greedy, isn't envious. Then I would ask myself, well, don't take my refuge in the aramana, in the object, or be the subject. How can I be the subject? Not by conceiving myself as somebody who's got to be the subject, because I don't have to do that. I am the subject. This pure awareness. This is what I am, pure awareness. And then the object of the awareness is the way it is, you know. So it's dependent on the conditions of the time and place. So this is like exploring, investigating experience. From the way you are, too, you know, the kind of character tendencies and that one has. So then, if you contemplate this, you know, really observe this. This is a skillful means, I admit. You know, the paticca samuppada. But by using that teaching to observe the reality of the present, the way it is in the present, you know, you're not coming from avijja or ignorance and getting caught up in the endless arising and ceasing of the conditions affecting you in the present moment. You begin to appreciate just this emptiness, this state of being, natural state of resting attentiveness, in which conditions arise and cease. So then, you know, this is, I am this pure awareness, I am that, the Sagadatta's tome. Now then, I'm not claiming this as some kind of personal identity. So it's not, you know, that I have reached the ultimate truth and then that could be coming from, you know, me as a separate individual, me as this person. But with I am that, it's a reflection, that's not a statement of personal attainment or claiming anything personally. And even that is necessary, say I am that is you know, rises and ceases too. But it is a statement, a kind of affirmation, so that this sense of being this increases, your confidence, the trusting in this awareness increases, connects. And then you're no longer caught in all the kind of critical proliferations of your personality and your cultural conditioning and your emotional habits and the loves and hates, likes and dislikes that are part of human experience in a community, you know, where we affect each other a lot, living together here at Chithurst. You know, we can't help but affect each other personally, you know, just because that's the way it is. We come into each other's consciousness. We see each other, listen to each other, and all this. So this has an effect, you know, some kind of effect on consciousness. So it's not no longer, you know, leave me alone. We've got to get rid of the troublemakers, you know, trying to control and the situation, so that what affects me isn't something too difficult for me to handle personally. We've got to make sure that anything, you know, any real challenging thing, don't let them in the gate. Only the nice guys. We only let the nice guys in. The good, the moral, the giving, the generous, ones I approve of, in other words. That don't threaten me too much or make too many demands. So in this sense of I am this awareness, this is a reflection. Again, I repeat that, it's not an ego statement. It's just noticing, you know, using language, using thought, more or less to affirm, to make this significant, this awareness. It gives it a significance at first, that because we tend to not see and notice it as significant. We've spent maybe our lifetime not noticing it at all, being aware, just being, you know, habits that we develop, lifetime of operating from the ego level all the time. So that's what, you know, we're obsessed with our egos and our feelings and our views and opinions. So then recognizing this is my true self. And that's not Buddhist. You don't have a self. So when I'm talking in orthodox Theravada terms, I never say this is my true self. Because one time I said that in a public talk, and one of the guardians of orthodoxy wrote me a very distressed letter. But I'm not trying to be, you know, I'm using language more for reflection than for accuracy on a doctrinal level. Ways of just bringing in, accepting, noticing, appreciating, treasuring this awareness. And so it's like, describe it as like a lover. You know, when you're in love with somebody, you want to be with them all the time. And when they're not around, you miss them. So this emptiness, this stillness, the Rumi and these Sufi poets write about it as the, you know, like the lover and that kind of thing. Well, it works also, you know. It does help to you know, on an emotional level, to really appreciate this is significant. It's not just mindfulness, you know, and just dismiss it, because the emotional life does take on, you know, how I feel about you, and you didn't do your chore properly, and that lady touched all the food on the counter, and somebody's always coming in late, and these things can dominate, you know, getting irritated, frustrated, or caught into all the worldly permutations that go on in any situation. So I tell a story about going off to the, after my first Vasa with Lungpo Cha, you know, too many monks, too much work, didn't like the work, didn't want to do the work, wanted to go off into nature and not live with all these monks and so forth. So I went off to Phupek Mountain with two other monks. And there I managed for 6 months to become obsessed with aversion towards one of the monks. This is a lesson, you know. Here I'm spending 6 months, and I was with two other monks, and the one that I had aversion toward wasn't there very much of the time. That also, I was averse to that. He couldn't do anything right, as far as I... And then the rational self said, don't be so silly, you know, you must be compassionate and not be angry. And so I was trying to smother this anger, this aversion. And then I just become obsessed with it, trying not to be angry and be understanding and compassionate. be nice about everything and get along and try and all that, and then at the same time just, you know, feeling incredible aversion and resentment towards this one monk. And it wasn't that he was doing anything, you know, that much. It just was, you know, like I wanted a life completely free from anything like that feeling. I didn't want that feeling. You know, and I left Wat Bapong with all its monks because there was too many annoying things going on around me. And then went up to this place, nice place up in the mountains, and then I managed to be annoyed continuously by this one monk. Well, that was an important lesson. I did learn from that. Because, you know, the desire, wasn't it? I desire to go to this ideal place, idealizing this place, and thinking that this is where the practice really is. I'm really going to get my samadhi and everything together here, and then maybe I might go back in to Wat Bapong. But this is real practice that I'm doing. And so it's full of me, mine, what I want, what I don't want. And so everything, every little thing seemed to aggravate, seemed to annoy me, because I was so greedy for this idealized experience, this perfect place. And it was probably one of the worst periods of my monastic life. So this is, you know, the here in this place, like Chithurst, you know, I've learned to just accept places as they are and the way things are. You know, just this is an acceptance of the way it is in the present. Because this, then, this is non-suffering. Not wanting things to be the way they are is suffering. I create that. I don't want it to be like this. That's the suffering. That's a dukkha. The way it is, even when it's not very pleasant, is still not suffering unless I get caught in, I don't want this, I don't like this. I get caught into that. So then this awareness, then this is my true nature. This is my real home. This is non-suffering. So it's like really, you know, using this way of reflection. Not through, you know, deluding yourself into some kind of, you know, from the self-view, but using words that somehow give you that sense of trust and appreciation and this imminent ability of attentiveness. So you realize it, you trust it, you rest in it. And then from this point on, then the path develops. You know how to really practice. You've given up, you know, you no longer have views about what good practice is or your ability or lack of it, because you've seen beyond just these tendencies, the conditioning of the mind, the self-view, the cultural preferences and opinions, beyond the orthodoxy of the tradition. Now this lover never is always present. Is sometimes, you know, think, where is it? And then just by opening, being present, I'm united with my lover. Works every time. This is kind of poetic, very unorthodox way to but the point of it is, it's not to become a Sufi mystic or anything like that, but what, pointing to the how to appreciate this, give it the priority in your life, you know. So this is where I'm at ease. This is where I'm. There's no suffering. This is the safety. This is home where I'm safe. I'm one with my lover. I'm at ease. Then I can deal with the changing conditions that happen around. You know, the comings and goings, the days and nights, the weather, the aging process, the praise and blame of the world. Because the strength is in this, rather than demanding the world, you know, making endless demands on the worldly level, that, you know, to not upset me and not confuse me or threaten me in any way, because that's an impossible demand. You're bound to fail. You're bound to be disappointed and despairing and disillusioned with the world, because that's the way the world is. It's not meant to be your home or your refuge or your safe place of safety. It can't be, and it's not supposed to be. So, noticing then, this is my real home. Now this, if you recognize this, and then cultivating this is bhavana, this word, Pali word bhavana, cultivating, developing this in daily life. It's not a matter of just meditation retreats, but of just like here in monastic form, and with the tradition, with the Vinaya, Theravada tradition. It's a form, it's a convention for the worldly, for living in the world. But it's not for attaching to the world, but gives us a way of living in the society that is beneficial to one's own self and to the society. It's a non-violent, based on, you know, of integrity and being content with little, not making endless demands or endlessly discontented, trying to get more and more, being part of the society, isn't it? Here we're still a part, we're living in this country, we're part of this society. And then our conventional relationship to this society is one of compassion. Love and compassion, rather than of just using the system or just complaining about it endlessly because the society isn't perfect and we can see all kinds of things we don't like about it and dwell on all the faults and distressing things we see happening in the society and getting caught up into that. It's easy enough to do. The idea of Buddhist monasticism is, it gives you a lifestyle or way of living in society where, say, the right livelihood, right action, right speech is part of the way we live here. We're not avoiding or rejecting the society. I mentioned these other, like Sufism or Advaita Vedanta, and that this is, some people get upset if you're Orthodox Buddhist, if you mention other approaches, because there's a strong commitment. I've heard Theravada and Buddha say, it's only through the Four Noble Truths, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, that you can ever get enlightened. Any other way is not it. I remember years ago, and when I became acquainted with Nisargadatta's book, I Am That, and then this very orthodox Theravadan came to stay with us in Hampstead, and he was from Asia, Indian, and he. And he was a Vipassana teacher. So I asked him, I said, what do you think of this? And he took it, and next day he came back and he said, oh, it's just Brahmanism. All they're getting maybe is third jhana or something like this. So he, it was a typical Indian put down. Indian Buddhists are oftentimes very threatened by Hinduism. So, when you're brought up in a society where you're a minority, an ethnic minority as a Buddhist, and then you see Hindus all around you, you naturally develop cultural prejudices and fears. The same with the Christians in Thailand. If you want to meet rabid Christians, it's the Thai Christians that are most threatened by Buddhism. Because Buddhism is everywhere, and they're the minority, and they're brought up developing this prejudices against the majority. Buddhists, they're not. So they worship idols and things like this, and Hindus, they believe in gods and all that kind of rubbish. In itself, they believe in Atman. And the Buddha said, there's no Atman. There's no self. And those Advaita people, they talk about the higher self. And they self with a capital S. It's wrong. It's not Buddhism. So, this is playing around on the conventional level with the symbols. Now, what I'm pointing to is, symbols are symbols, and it's how we use them, our attitudes, is the important thing. All conditions take you, if you really pay attention to a condition of any sort, it will take you to the unconditioned, because that's just the way it is. Now the way to use the Theravada approach is, because it's kind of precision tool. But then we can grasp it and form views and opinions about no self, and all the other religions are not quite there, and Nisargadatta's only got third jhana and. And dismiss the whole lot, the Sufis, they talk about drinking wine. You can't get enlightened if you're drinking wine, can you? It's against the five precepts. It's wrong. So, the whole logic and reason come from the thinking process. So noticing this, that's why I emphasize so much getting to recognize the limitation of language and convention, and that's their nature. They are limited, and that's not a criticism of them, because it's through the limitation, it's simplification for one thing, the Theravada simplifies But the aim is not to become a Theravada Buddhist, but to get to know the way it is, the ultimate truth, the Dhamma, to see the Dhamma. And so the different upayas or skillful means, are merely, expedient means towards helping us to want to see this, to rec your own character, your kind of the way you individually are. You get to know how to use the way you are as a skillful means. Now you can't say you have to do it exactly like I do. The way I do it is the right way, and if you don't do it like me, you'll never get anywhere. That's conceit. Sounds like conceit to me. But the way I am, the character I have, how to use this. This is conditioned, but you develop awareness around these conditions to recognize, realize the Dhamma, the truth of the way it is.